Welcome to Cover to Cover. This is Richard A. Lupon.
And I'm Richard Walensky, and our guest is Anne Rule, one of the major practitioners of the art of true crime writing. Her latest book is Dead by Sunset, and it's the story of a man named Bradley Cunningham who murdered his wife, one of his wives, and ruined a lot of lives in the process. We generally don't do true crime books here, and in a sense, I'm interested in this story and in this novel.
At least you know the difference. A lot of people don't.
I'm interested in this story and in this book. However, the writing of true crime is different from the novel writing, and I want to get into that and also into the relationship of you as interviewer, you as writer to the criminals themselves. But first, let's talk a little about Dead by Sunset. What is the story? Who is Brad Cunningham?
Well, basically, Brad Cunningham is a man who seemingly had everything in life, as most of my people do. He was handsome as a young man, brilliant. He had two scholarships, academic to the University of Washington. He had an athletic scholarship. He played varsity football for the Huskies. By the time he was 30, he had a $14 million fortune. By the time he was 38, he had married 5 women, all of them, without exaggeration, beautiful. The thing that fascinated me was that these are very brilliant women, doctors, lawyers, master's degrees in education, bankers, women who could have had anyone, and yet Brad Cunningham was able to convince each of them that he was their prince, that he was the perfect man, and that the women who had come before them were morally loose, bad mothers, that he would have been victimized by women. And each new woman wanted to make his life happy again and to create a life for his children. And yet he destroyed every one of them in one way or another, emotionally, financially, and in the case of Cheryl Keaton, who was his 4th wife, who was a brilliant litigating attorney, a senior partner in her law firm, who had everything going for her, he destroyed her completely. He murdered her. He set up the scene to look like an accident. He left her body on the freeway west of Portland in the fast lane in the van. And all things being equal, cars coming back from the beach that night, and it was September 21st, 1986, there would have been a horrendous pileup of cars, and many people would have died, and Cheryl's head injuries would have been commensurate with what happened, with an accident. And had it not been for a good Samaritan who explained to me that he could not go on by because he saw an infant seat behind the driver's seat, and he thought there might be a baby in that van. He pulled over to the side of the road, ran across all the lanes of the freeway, got in the van, backed it off, and there was Cheryl Keaton's body, already dead. Police could tell instantly she hadn't been in an accident. She'd been murdered. And even so, it took 8 years for this finally to come to fruition in criminal court. So Brad Cunningham is a sociopath. He is a narcissistic personality, meaning that he thinks that he's special, that he deserves whatever he wants, because there are different rules in life for him than for other people. And he also has a paranoid personality disorder. He's done such terrible things to people that, as one psychiatrist explained it, he expects it to come back to him, that everybody thinks like he does.
Brad Cunningham, in the end, murdered only one person. He's in jail now, right?
He's in prison now for life with a 22-year minimum. As far as we know, he murdered only one person. I'm not quite finished with my investigative process on Cunningham.
Well, the reason why I ask that is because a number of your other books deal with serial killers.
Yes.
And he is not a serial killer, at least we don't think he is. The question I have here is he like a serial killer? Does he fit the pattern? Would you look at this man and say, yes, this man would have murdered more than one person.
Serial killers are different in that they are literally addicted to murder. Murder is the substance that they use to first to get a high and then to feel just normal. And they murder closer and closer together, just as a drug user needs more and more of the substance to feel normal. With Brad, he has so many of the characteristics, the total antisocial behavior. He has the mask that, say, a Ted Bundy wore that seemed wonderful, unless you get a little peek of the monster behind it. I would not be surprised to find out that Brad Cunningham had committed serial murders. He's enough of the type that it could have gone another way, and I'm not sure that it didn't, but I cannot say at this point that it did not.
We had a recent guest here on Cover to Cover named Andrew Vax. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
Of course I am, yes.
His concern, almost to the point of obsession, is child abuse and working against child abusers. From your own book, Dead by Sunset, I think I detected some sort of similarity between child abusers, wife abusers, other perpetrators of domestic violence, and somehow it seems that there's a thread that runs all the way out from there to single or serial killers. Do you agree that there is such a thread?
Absolutely. I'm working on my 13th book. I have yet, with one exception, and I say 13 books and 1,400 articles about murder, with one exception, I have not found a serial killer or a killer in a domestic abuse situation, as this book is, who did not have abuse in his or her background. And I used to say, people would say, what causes serial killers? And I would say abandonment, rejection, child abuse, sexual abuse under the age of 5. At a time when a child usually develops a conscience. When kids are about 3, they begin to notice that if they kick the dog, it hurts the dog just as they're hurt. If they pull their little sister's hair, it hurts her. And so they see somebody outside themselves. I got a little sophistication as I went through. I've been doing this for about 25 years now and realized that if every child who was abused grew up to be a serial killer, we'd be in terrible trouble. I think that it's child abuse combined perhaps with a genetic predisposition to violence. Now, say a child is born with that genetic predisposition into a family where he or she is loved and comforted and cosseted against the world, then there's no soil for it to grow. But if you get the terrible synchronicity of the genetic predisposition and an abysmal situation in the home, then everything, the conditions are right to grow serial killers.
So if you get this nature versus nurture debate, what you're telling us, Andrew, is that what we're dealing with here is nature plus nurture.
Absolutely.
Okay, Richard Walensky.
In the case of Bradley Cunningham, his father strikes me as a man who's Bradley Cunningham without the murderous streak, or perhaps even with it, only he apparently didn't kill anybody.
In a sense, after Brad was incarcerated, his sister finally felt safe enough to talk to me. There were two things going there. There was the father. I have to go back a couple generations. It's not just this generation and the one before. It's the whole family viewpoint, in this case, of how do we treat women. Brad's paternal grandfather felt that women, you couldn't treat women too well because they'd betray you. His wife did. She ran off with another man, left him with Brad's father and his uncle. And Brad's father told his daughters that, I mean, you didn't educate women because they were only good to be sexually responsive in the bedroom and cook good meals in the kitchen. And this was from the father's side. This is what Brad got from his own father. His mother was a very erratic, emotional woman, and she would line the children up in the afternoon to wait for their father to come home and beat them. And the sister, Susan, said, we were all so frightened. she said, my dad didn't really want to hit us, but once he got into it, he really enjoyed it. So this was the family climate that Brad grew up in.
In the nature versus nurture debate, it sounds to me as if it was a ripe breeding ground, given the fact that his father was a certain personality, and given the fact there were no other men in the house to counter that personality, it would seem that if there's nothing to say, don't be like me, he might wind up that way.
Absolutely. And in his whole life, the only person that I have found that I think Brad had any affection for or any commitment to emotionally was his father. When his father died, he cried like a baby. When his wife died, and admittedly, I'm convinced that he killed her. But when the police came to the door, they said, your wife has been killed. And he said, was it in an accident? And they, of course, said, we're not sure yet. There were no tears.
Well, it was his ex-wife at that point.
Estranged wife, yeah.
Estranged wife.
Yeah. He'd gone on.
The women involved in this book, okay, the first wife was the kind of woman who had a very low self-image,
mm-hmm.
might actually be the prototypical abused wife until she finally says enough is enough.
Yeah.
But the later wives, particularly the final two, Cheryl and Sarah,
mm-hmm.
they didn't fit that pattern at all.
Not at all. And that's why I almost walked away from this book, because I went 2 years ago to the bail hearing, and I saw this man come into the courtroom. Actually, I thought he was an attorney until I saw he had trouble opening the door, and I looked, he had handcuffs on and leg irons on. These beautiful, intelligent women got up in the stand, and they wouldn't really answer the prosecutor's questions. And they were holding back. They would answer just enough, and I thought, what's the matter with them? And then I realized they were frightened. They were looking down at Brad, and they thought, if he gets out on bail, he'll hurt me. It was Sarah, who is an anesthesiologist, a highly respected doctor, pretty enough to be a movie star. Several mistresses. One of the mistresses was an attorney. Another was a banker. And I really did say, no, this isn't for me. This guy's too scary. This guy's too litigious. But I didn't even get out of the courthouse, and I thought, uh-uh. There's a poetic justice in a female taking this guy on, because for the last 40 years, he has abused women. I'm going to chance it. I'm going to go back and turn over all of the rocks and all of the hidden things and see. But what I found was he is so charismatic. He's so intelligent, and he can maintain the mask for longer than almost anyone I've ever encountered. As Sarah said, until the night that Cheryl was killed, Brad was always where he said he would be. He always showed up for dates. I never worried that he wasn't where he was supposed to be. He would tell me he was so lucky to have me. He loved me so much. He was so proud of me. He was everything that any single woman, of which I fall in that group, it doesn't matter how smart we are, we're kind of waiting for the prince to come along, the perfect man who will appreciate us for what we are. And that's what Brad was able to convey to brilliant, educated, beautiful women.
We're talking on Cover to Cover with Anne Rule, author of a book, Dead by Sunset. Dick Lupoff.
It seems to me that the story in Dead by Sunset is really a two-part story with a kind of fulcrum or bridge between them. Part one is the incredible, horrifying career of Brad Cunningham.
Mm-hmm.
Part two is how he came to be caught. How did he get caught? That's the fulcrum between the two sides of the story.
It was difficult to begin with, and it's hard to talk about Brad without talking about O.J., because there are so many parallels between the two men. But basically, it was what I call a mom-and-pop murder, where a husband kills a wife or vice versa. Even lay people have become quite savvy about forensic science, physical evidence, blood, fibers, fingerprints, semen, body fluids. We know about DNA. When a husband kills a wife, all of the things that police look for, of course they're there. Of course his fingerprints were on the registration of the van. because he'd been living with Cheryl until 8 months before. So they didn't have, the police didn't have the stuff that they really need to bring a solid case.
So in a sense, there's plenty of evidence there, but it's no good.
It's no good because it'd be expected to be there. It's a circumstantial case. We knew that he hated this woman. They were in an acrimonious divorce, a bitter struggle for the custody of these three little boys, 6, 4, and 2. The prosecutor of Washington County, Oregon, hesitated to go forward with criminal charges because should he not have enough to get a conviction, then double jeopardy would attach. If Brad were acquitted, he could never try him again. So they kept working to find more evidence. The family and Cheryl's law firm were so outraged that he was going on with his life. He married Sarah, the doctor, took her for $1.5 million, had her adopt his children, and knowing that it wasn't going to work, and then he sued her for child support for his children. I mean, this is Brad. Then her law firm got a civil attorney, Mike Shin, and they had to go to 4 civil attorneys to get one who was not afraid of for his life. Mike Shin was a single guy, didn't have kids living with him. He took on the civil suit against Bradley Cunningham to find him civilly liable for Cheryl's murder. Now, it's easier to get a civil judgment. All you have to have is the preponderance of evidence. You can bring in all kinds of neat evidence and testimony and depositions you'd never get into a criminal trial. Brad laughed at this. He didn't even show up for the civil trial. He didn't have an attorney there. The jury, however, found him civilly liable for Cheryl's death and brought a judgment of $81.7 million. It was moot. By this point, he declared bankruptcy. But it brought the whole suit along. It gave the prosecutor a feeling, we got to go for a criminal indictment, even though we may not get it. We're going to try for it. And Brad had continued to live out this bizarre life where he used women. His last woman was a young country girl, absolutely gorgeous, whom he convinced that topless dancing was an art form. And she supported him. And after he was safely in prison, she met. And all these women came out of the woodwork and wanted to talk to me. And she was bringing home $25,000, $30,000 a month, topless dancing in Houston in a very exclusive club. And she said, Brad would never let me keep the money. He took it at the end of the evening and told me I was selfish if I wanted to keep any.
Sounds like a pimp.
Basically, that's what he was.
Richard Walensky.
The way that he was finally brought to justice is through the wrongful death suit. This seems to be a way for retribution in the case of those who can't quite get a conviction, or the Dan White case, I believe, comes to mind in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about that, I want to switch for a second to O.J. My guess is that by the time this airs, I'm not sure what the outcome will be, but in either case, can the families of Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman sue O.J. no matter what?
Yes. If he should not be convicted, I will embarrass myself. All along I've said he'll be convicted. And I'm willing to look like a fool because I've believed this from the very beginning. Yes, a family can seek some kind of closure. Money does not mean anything to a family. They'd much rather have Nicole and Ron, or I've written one other case where a family, besides the Cunningham case, where a family sued and then it went into a criminal trial. It's usually done backwards from the O.J. case, but it's a way to say, we know you did it. We want on a public record someplace to have someone acknowledge that you have killed somebody we love very much.
But isn't this a sort of double jeopardy? I mean, once you get off, once a jury says you're innocent, then let's suppose you are innocent. They can still sue you, and the preponderance of evidence, again, unless there's, you know, a smoking gun or a non-smoking gun saying you didn't do it, you're stuck again in a second trial, and let's assume you're innocent for a moment.
Now, I'm not a lawyer, but as I understand it, yes, you are. Because there are different standards of culpability and there are different evidence standards for my purposes, I got so much more information from, I had all the videotapes of the civil trial than I did, in a sense, from the criminal trial, even though Brad defended himself in the criminal trial, and that was great for a writer too. It's all a public record and I could see how he acted, how he sounded. But it is one way to have some closure. And I'm sure that Nicole's family and Ron's family will sue civilly.
No matter what.
Maybe no matter what. Maybe if there is a criminal conviction, maybe that will be enough. They can go on with their lives.
There is a quotation in the front of your book from the 6th century B.C. I found this just astonishing. Let me read it aloud because it's brief. Written laws, which were like spiders' webs and would catch, it is true, the weak and poor, but could easily be broken by the mighty and the rich. And those of us who are news junkies and court TV watchers and who have been following high-profile trials of recent years, the Von Bulow case, the Menendez brothers case, and many others, I have a terrible feeling that even though that quotation is over 2.5 millennia old, still has aptness.
It does, and it kind of gives me chills. You think I'm a nut. But I open books and I put my finger in, and so many times I come up with exactly the quote that I need for the book I'm writing. I had a quote from Paradise Lost for the Bundy book about, you know, Ted Bundy. I pick this quote long before O.J. and Nicole and Ron Goldman, before any of this, before it had happened. And yet it fits, and it's just as true today as it was centuries ago.
And yet when we see this, speaking now as an ordinary citizen, we're taught in our civics classes when we're 12 years old, concepts like equal justice under the law. And when we listen to trials or read transcripts, the lawyers seem to bludgeon us day after day with phrases like the search for the truth.
Yeah.
The actuality is that whoever has the deep pockets and can hire the dream team of lawyers and forensic experts and jury consultants, it makes a mockery of the concept of equal justice, or does it?
Well, I think it does, in a sense. Now, we've all been watching, the day we're talking, Johnny Cochran, who is making very lucid, persuasive arguments that really are not touching on the essence of this case, but will perhaps be very convincing to the jury. And we know that O.J.'s dream team has had millions and millions of dollars to do what they want. Now, in another sense, Brad was bankrupt when he went to trial. And yet the state of Oregon hired a series of attorneys for him. He had three sets of attorneys. He fired them all. In the end, the last set that he'd fired were retained by the state to sit beside him as legal advisors. And they were paid almost $250,000 by the taxpayers of Oregon, who aren't that rich, to support him, to give him advice, even though he wouldn't let them do any of the questioning because he was in control. Then you take it to the poor black murder defendant, who may, in some areas, have a very inept public defender and may not get justice. I'm sure that justice is influenced by money. And anybody who would say differently is putting her head in the sand.
You mentioned an interesting fact that had me going when I was reading the book, which is that Cunningham served as his own attorney, and as we all know, a fool is his own attorney. But I want you to speculate for a second. Let us suppose that those attorneys had acted on Brad's behalf. Brad got up there and made a complete fool of himself.
He did.
A total ass. No matter what, you'd be inclined to convict the guy. What if they had kept him off the stand? What if they had presented the strongest possible case? Would he have been convicted, do you think?
No. If he had allowed Tim Lyons and Kevin Hunt to speak for him, if, and this would be impossible for him, if he had not gotten on the stand, and it's always a rule of thumb, I don't care what they do in TV, that a murder defendant does not testify, because once he does, he opens himself up to all manner of cross-examination. The thing that convicted Brad Cunningham, and there was a wonderful irony, Cheryl Keaton was played two roles, and so did Brad Cunningham. Cheryl was both the victim, and she was the prime star witness, because Judge Alexander allowed her final statements when she left a note for her brother saying, I'm going to meet Brad. If I don't come back, come and get me. When she told her mother, Brad's going to kill me. I know you don't believe me, but he is. Those were allowed into the trial as res justi or deathbed statements. They were not kept out as hearsay. So she was both the witness and the victim. Brad was both the defendant and the defense attorney. I think had he allowed these very, very adequate attorneys to speak for him and not had this monumental ego that had to take over, he'd be free.
Ann Rule, we have the case here of Brad Cunningham. How many Brad Cunninghams do you think there are out there right now?
More than we'd even like to think. According to the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the Bible for psychiatrists, 3% of all males and 1% of all females are antisocial personalities. That doesn't mean they're killers. They're the kind of people that'll step on your face to take your job, lie to you, steal your money. But a significant percentage of those are the sadistic killers, the people who will go beyond taking your job and take your life. And so just because he's locked up, and some of the other people I've written about are locked up, it doesn't mean that we mustn't be aware. And I hate to think that we're all jaundiced, and I still trust most people, but you have to listen for what's going on behind the mask. And I always say, if somebody you meet seems too good to be true too quickly, he probably is, or she probably is.
I'm thinking of another recent case in which the defendant acted as his own lawyer, and that was the Colin Ferguson case.
Mm-hmm. In the Colin Ferguson case, I believe that he is clinically, medically, and legally insane. There's a vast difference between the antisocial personality who knows the difference between right and wrong, but it doesn't matter because he's special. I don't think Colin Ferguson, from my observation of him, knew the difference between right and wrong. I think he was so far removed from reality. For instance, I watched on Saturday Night Live, they did a satire on Colin Ferguson. I couldn't tell the difference between the real trial and the satire because Ferguson was totally off the wall.
It's a notion, it was proposed very recently, there's a local case here in the East Bay of a fellow who was going around videotaping young girls undressing at night through their bedroom windows. His defense attorney came up with, I thought, a fascinating idea. He says, obviously this man must be insane because no normal person would do that. And you know, my wife and I were chatting about that afterwards, and this could be applied to almost any crime, because by definition a crime, or almost by definition in our society, a crime is a violation of the norm. If we accept this principle, there's no such thing as a criminal.
I've been to hundreds of trials. I've seen very few cases where somebody got off on an insanity defense. It goes back to not do they care about other people, but were they aware of the difference between right and wrong? The rule of thumb that works for me is if they make efforts to cover up their crimes, if they do it stealthily in the dark of night through somebody's window shades and they're not standing there where everybody in the neighborhood can see them, or if someone commits a murder and he's found babbling incoherently next to the body, then you can be pretty sure he is psychotic medically and legally. But if he covers up, if he has an alibi, if he runs from the scene, if he washes up, if he changes his clothes, he's not crazy. His behavior is not normal by our standards, but he is sane. There's a big difference between being abnormal and being insane.
You had an interesting experience happen that you turned into a book, which is that you worked on a hotline with Ted Bundy. And you got to know him while you were working on the book about the killings that he eventually did. Was there anything in Bundy himself to show this? And was Bundy sane?
There was nothing aberrant about Ted Bundy as far as I could see. He was so good on the suicide hotlines. We saved lives together. He walked me to my car at 4 a.m. and said, "Ann, be sure you lock the door. I don't want anything bad to happen to you on the way home." The only thing, and this is in retrospect, about Bundy that was abnormal is he never talked about sex. Now, most men, when they're alone with a woman for hours and hours and hours, will bring up the subject. And I used to tease the homicide detectives. I said, "You guys are so much kinkier than Ted Bundy ever acted." But that really was a clue. Sex was dangerous to him. Forbidden thoughts. He had so many of them that he had to keep a tight lid. So while he shared possibly the truth about his childhood with me, he was a man that lived such a compartmentalized life that nobody in one compartment knew anybody else. He worked for the governor. He was a student in abnormal psychology, graduated with distinction. He had high school friends. He had college friends. He had crisis clinic friends, but none of us ever knew each other until after, because he had so many secrets.
Afterward, did he apologize to you?
In a sense. He was angry with me when I wrote The Stranger Beside Me, and it came out in 1980. He said I'd taken advantage of him, which I hadn't, because I always told him I was working on the book. In 1989, he wrote to me from death row in Florida, and he said, "Ann, you're not a bad person. You were only doing your job. You really don't understand anything about serial murder." I found out last week, after all these years, from Bob Keppel, the man who got the confession from Bundy the day before he died. And he said, "Ted told me that of all the people who were honest, there were only three with him. Bob Keppel himself, the detective in Colorado, and me." And he said, "Ted had a book, your book, The Stranger Beside Me, and he'd written in all the margins in red ink." And he said, "Ann didn't go far enough," as he was saying to Bob Keppel. And Keppel said, "But she could go no further, Ted, because you didn't tell her the whole story." It sounds funny to think that a serial killer, to be relieved that a serial killer thought you were honest, but I always was. I never lied to him.
We've been talking on Cover to Cover with Ann Rule, author of a book, Dead by Sunset. I'm Richard Walensky with Richard A. Lupoff.